Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening if you happen to be in Switzerland, where Donna Leon is currently speaking to me. We're here to talk about, look at this, her wonderful memoir, Wandering Through Life. And I have to say, having read it, that she really has wandered through life. Yeah,
I continue to.
Indeed. But anyway, we have lots of things we can talk about. And let's start in New Jersey, because, you know, you grew up on a farm in New Jersey. And do you know, in a way, you parallel the First Lady of Iceland, who grew up on a farm in Canada, but, you know, came from a sort of similar background. And just one moment while I yell at my husband, because I can hear the dog. One sec. Sorry, there I am. So tell us about your young life on the farm.
We lived for a couple of years on my grandfather's farm because there was a separate house that he would give to members of the family when they wanted it. And everybody wanted to live on a farm, and I'm very glad I did. In a way, I'm glad also medically. The more I read and the more I speak to doctors, the more I realize that people who grow up on farms tend to be healthier, particularly in terms of any allergies. Because if you live on a farm, it's not clean. You're living in a dirty environment. And apparently this is good for children because they pick up antibodies, which later in life will help them. I'm never sick. I'll probably get pneumonia tomorrow, but
I hope not.
So do I. I've never been seriously ill in my life, nor has my brother. And we both lived for, 3 years, surrounded by cow shit and horse shit and animals and dirt. But it didn't then make us sick. We were healthy kids. And it was good to live around animals.
Indeed. But, you know, I think there's a slightly larger picture here because, you know, I'm slightly older than you are. And we grew up, both of us, eating real food, not packaged food, processed food. You know, I'm a war child. So, you know, 1940. So my parents had a victory garden. Mm-hmm. And even though we lived in a suburb of Chicago, we still could drive just a few miles outside Winnetka and we could pull corn off, off the stalks. We could dig up wonderful. I've never since found a tomato that tasted like the tomatoes that came in that black earth of Illinois. Yeah. And we were feral children too. You know, we ran around, we bicycled all the time. We swam in Lake Michigan when it was like 45 degrees.
And our parents weren't hysterical if we were 15 minutes late for dinner.
No, in fact, they didn't, you know, I would wave them or sometimes I would get up and go off before they ever got up on the weekends. And, you know, I wouldn't appear until dinner.
To bring up the history, there was no alternative to junk food then. You ate food. And there were not the people around who menaced children. Children were safe to go out and play, and they could trust strangers. And that's gone in most places. And so I think that those two elements would help a child be, more calm, I think, and have more fun.
Real food, real exercise, lots of playtime. I mean, I think I can't remember how old I was when we got the first television in the neighborhood. It was a little tiny thing, you know, with a little round screen. And the people who had it kindly invited us over, you know, us kids on the block to come over. We'd sit there in a little circle. You know, it seems
magical.
It's magic. But we weren't sitting looking at screens. So made a big difference. So right. So why were you on the farm? Did your family kind of move around?
No, we were stationary in New Jersey. It was just a choice that they made because it was so nice. It was a lovely house. It was a big house. And we were maybe, a 10-minute walk from my grandfather's house. And we chose to live there. And then my father and mother, as people do, they bought a house and we moved into that house. And then I grew up in the sub. I moved from the farm to the suburbs, but the distance was 5 miles, perhaps.
And so at some point in your schooling, you either abandoned it or you moved on to some educational institution.
Yeah, I did. And then when I finished university, I took the next step to graduate school and spent far more time there than I should have. But I say that in retrospect, that it was an attempt not to have to confront this world of employment and business and going to the office, because I could continue to do what I loved, which was to read. Not only that, but I could talk about it. I was paid to talk about it. And I couldn't imagine a better job. But then a friend of mine, an Italian friend, she wasn't really a friend, she was a classmate in high school, called me and asked me if I would be her sort of duenna to go to Italy, because she wanted to go to Rome and study painting, but her mother wouldn't let her go without someone to keep. Girls didn't travel alone in 1960, whenever it was. So I said, yeah, sure, I'll go with you. And we went off to Rome. And my first week was with her distant relatives, her great aunts, or I don't know, second cousins or something, in a little village in the south in Italy. And we were treated like princesses. Everybody was always kissing you or holding your arm or grabbing you and showing you the church or showing you something or feeding you or giving you a coffee. And I thought, because my family's Irish. And so there wasn't a lot of emotional excess there. And I thought, wow, these people really know what to do with their lives. And so I stayed. We went to Rome and we went our separate ways. She found the man to whom she's still married 60 years later.
Wow. 60
and 4 kids later. And I'm still in love with Italy and still going back as often as I can, simply because I was like, what's his name? Conrad Lawrence's, I think they were geese. When the geese hatched, if he was there, they imprinted on him and he became their mother. I was imprinted on Italy. And so it's not my mother, but certainly it's the great love of my life.
What was your first encounter with Venice?
A friend of mine, in fact, two friends of mine that come from the States, and like tourists, which we were, even though I was living in Rome, we said, oh, man, where will we go? Let's go to Florence. Let's go to, why don't we go to Venice? We came in on a train, the overnight train from Rome, and I think it got in at 5 o'clock. It was dawn. We got out of the train and out of the train station, and I saw this film set for that Catherine Hepburn movie where she's in Venice and she falls in the water. I said, my God, it's all built on water. It's all water. And I was really knocked down by the excessive beauty, the throwaway beauty, the almost hysterical beauty of everything I saw. We walked up Strada Nuova, we found rooms, and then for 3 or 4 days, I just walked around like a drunk, going from bar to bar, fill up my glass again, please, sir. And I still have that same response to the city. When I've been away for a time and I go back, I think this is, human beings aren't clever enough to have made this. This is too much, because it is overwhelming. Still, after, 50 years that I've been in and out, but mainly living there, it still overwhelms me.
So walking, it is a walking city, but it's also a city, and you wrote about it brilliantly in one of the more recent Brunettis when they're off on the water. When I was there the first time, it was 102 degrees. It was in June. Never again am I coming to the Mediterranean in June, Lord. But anyway, it was so hot that my husband and I took to the Vaporetti, because at least, you know, we could get some cool. So we went out into the lagoons and the islands. You know, wonderful. We went to look at the mosaics. We went, you know, we went to the, of course, the glass factories themselves are hot. But anyway, you know, we went to see the glass, and then we went to see the lovely island with the lace making history. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. most people think just about the glass, but there's a gorgeous lake making history. What mm-hmm. is the name of the island with the Byzantine mosaiics that is so absolutely beautiful?
Torcello.
Yeah, Torcello. And I've never been to Ravello. And so this was kind of the closest I could get, because mm-hmm. Istanbul, or rather Byzantium, is a city that I truly love and have spent mm-hmm. a lot of time in. I'm crazy about mosaics. So it was wonderful to go and see, you know, the Madonna and so forth in Torcello. Mm-hmm. Which was the book that you wrote when, in fact, much of it takes place out on the lagoons?
Yeah, it was the one, I think it's the one, there's a couple. There's one where Signorina Elettra falls in love. It ends badly. And there's one, the name of,
I could look it up. Sorry, I don't have a copy of the book here. So
no, it's one of the maybe 5 years ago.
Yeah, something like
where
that.
Things happen. Because he's out on one of the islands. He's out on Sant'Erasmo, the farmer's island where all the vegetable and fruit farms are. I just can't remember the name of it.
And then there's the, you know, which you don't, but there's the graveyard of the funeral island, yeah. which, you know, has its own.
Is bizarre.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, but those are real questions in an island community like that. You know, it's a question in New Orleans, for example. You know, what do you do when people die? You know, how do you bury them? How do you dispose of the bodies? And for Venice, that was a real challenge.
Yeah. Surprisingly, really surprisingly, more and more people are being cremated in Venice.
No, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all.
I don't think it's because of the trouble with space as that they are saying this is easier, this is faster, this is less trouble for my relatives. Because
have you ever been in an ossuary?
I have been to places where there are lots of very small graves, yes, special rooms where the remains, the ashes are kept.
I first encountered one in a crypt in Lima, Peru, in 1975. And I still remember being guided down into the ossuary under the cathedral. And there were bins of bones. And some of them were arranged tastefully, like the skulls in concentric circles. And mm-hmm. some of them were just bins of bones. And right on the spot, I said to myself, I'm not doing this. Yeah. You know, I don't want to be reduced to bones in a bin. Yeah. And I think cremation would be a better way to go. So, you know, it all depends on your personal thing. But I can see for Venice that it would be a reasonable solution. I'm also happy that Venice, in fact, I just read, what is the new place here? Bar Harbor, Maine. A lot of cities are taking a sensible approach about cruise ships, you know, to just overwhelm them. And certainly mm-hmm. it's been a huge problem for you in regard to Venice and, you know, for people who live there, and are now limiting the number of ships and the number of passengers and so mm-hmm. forth that can come in. And I hope that Venice will stay tough about that.
It's not likely.
I mean, it's a lot of money. You know, but it's also a lot of wear and tear on the fabric.
There's very little indication that the people governing the city much care about that.
Really,
they're interested in making money. An example would be this latest news story about the pass to enter the city. They say now it was in the Italian press and the Swiss press. That starting maybe next year, it's always starting next year, there will be a €5 fee to enter the city. And then the article, which was given to the paper by the city council, the article says that €5 a person for the people who come will cost the city more than what they will earn from the 5 euros.
Ah, because of the collection and all the
collection, the need for a structure, the need for a system. They don't want to do it, and they're not going to do it because it is impossible to do. How can you stop a person and say, show me your pass to be in Italy? And he says, I don't need a pass. My mother's in the hospital. Get out of my way. Or if you have a gate where you stop the people who are coming, all right, you stop and you block one of the 4 or 5 ways that you can get into the city, and you check everybody's paper, the people at the end of the line aren't going to like waiting for an hour, because someone's going to object and say, no, but, and here, show papers. It is impossible for them to do it. I've been saying this from the beginning, but people seem to believe that the city council really wants to stop people coming from Venice.
Oh.
Why would they want that? Why would they want people not to come? Because they bring money.
Well, they do. So something, you know, that you have to deal with in writing your Brunetti books is...
And one should bear in mind as well that the mayor of Venice is not Venetian.
I didn't know that.
He's not Venetian. He was born in Mestre.
Ah, okay.
He's from the mainland. So he doesn't have the city in his bones the way people who were born and live there. But this is turning into a sermon.
Well, let's go back. We've talked about how you got to Italy and how you first came to Venice. When did you first encounter opera?
I saw a performance of Tosca in the old Met in the 60s, maybe 64, 65. With Zinka Milanov. I had read about the opera, but I had never been. I'd heard some on the radio. I used to listen to the Saturday afternoon Met broadcasts. But seeing it, it was like seeing Venice. I was just bowled over by how wonderful it was. And of course, I did giggle by how silly it is. And Tosca really is. What does he call it? A stunning... something vulgar little shocker. I think that's what an American musicologist called vulgar. And it is, but it is also wonderful.
Well, you have to separate the story from the music very often in order to, and you know, one of the things I really dislike about updating so many operas to a contemporary or reasonably contemporary setting is that they didn't make a lot of sense to begin with. And when you take context, you know, it's...
you it's just really, increase the confusion.
Yeah, you just... I mean, my poor husband, who has been dragged by me to opera houses all over the world, you know, I still remember him sitting there in Drottningholm, where, you know, the opera theater faces west. So the midnight sun in Sweden, Stockholm,
yeah.
Still shining on you. And, you know, people are passing out. And the woman next to Rob said, you know, that on an ordinary evening, you know, a whole lot of people had carried out. And of course, it's en banc seating in that old fashioned. So if somebody goes down, you know, the entire row has to, which like is also true of the Sydney Opera House, which I find, you know, really. Anyway, my poor husband, on many occasions, has sort of looked at me as like, why are we here? You know, why are we watching this ridiculous modern version of, Verdi opera in Dresden? Or you told me that when we're in Rio, you told me that Candide would be in English or have English surtitles, and it was sung in Portuguese with Portuguese surtitles. So he had absolutely no idea what was happening. it's, you know, it's a world of its own. But Donna, because I grew up right outside Chicago, I got to my first opera when I was 12 years old. I had a friend whose parents were very cultured, and she took me to see Renata Tebaldi, Traviata in a dress. Are you ready for this? In a dress that was strewn with real camellias. And she was a majestic lady, as you
know.
And she was only 12, so we're talking 1952 here. And I was just, I could hardly believe. I mean, Traviata does make sense in a lot of ways. You know, it is.
Yeah, it does.
It is a plot that is not, you know, hard to imagine. And of course, was difficult to see Renata Debaldi, who was robust, dying of consumption at the end in any believable way, but still.
Yeah, come on.
And then I went off to Stanford, and the San Francisco Bay had, you know, the San Francisco Opera at the War Memorial Opera House, but it had some smaller opera companies. So I, bragging, got to see Birgit Nilsson in her debut at Turandot. That's one of the most electric things I have ever, I'm telling
with
you.
With Franco Corelli.
Oh, yeah.
With Franco Corelli.
That woman had a voice that was, it was as though a giant bell rang, you know. So when I read your list in your book, the reason I bring this up, Donna has a list of opera singers that she thinks were monumental, important to her. But my list is different. And part of it probably is that I started watching it sooner than you did.
Yeah. Who would be on your list?
Well, definitely Nilsson. I got to see UC Berling towards the end of his life. I saw Callias. I saw Tibaldi. I was crazy about, what is his name now? I wrote all this down for our first conversation and now I've sort of forgotten it. I remember when there was a big conversation at the Met when Otello moved in, I think it was Domingo sang his first Otello. And now it was Nicolai Gedda, that's who I was trying to think of. I thought he was a superb tenor for the things that he did. I got to see Joan Sutherland. You know, she was amazing. I did see Milanova for sure. So I used to, for a long time when I lived in Virginia, I would fly up to New York and go to the Met every couple of weeks. But a great sorrow to me is I never saw anything in the old Met. But I remember Samuel Ramey, his debut, when he came in on the chariot and whatever that, you know, it was an older, like Handel or something opera that was astonishing. And one of my favorite memories was seeing Simone Boccanegra on stage in New York at the Met, which is really grand opera. And the very next week, I was at Glyndebourne when it became a chamber opera. And it was fascinating to compare them. But anyway, people who are watching this don't care about, you know, my opera experiences or you. But Donna, the reason I bring it up is that Donna is very much involved in music. So tell us a little bit about your support of Joyce and these musical groups that you're doing.
Years ago, I knew I was best friends with Alan Curtis, who was a Baroque specialist and conductor. And we started, it began a dinner conversation. He was planning a recording, but he didn't know. So I said, well, why don't we try to do it together? So we ended up recording an opera and presenting it in a couple of cities. And it was so much fun that I said, oh, Alan, let's do this again. And so over the course of 10 years, we did about 10 recordings, all of Handel operas, because Alan was a sublime Handel lunatic. And then with his death, his orchestra stopped, and I became involved with another orchestra, Il Pomo d'Oro, the Golden Apple. And I still, to this day, am with them. And we do the same thing. We record, and they have risen, I must say, to stardom in the 10 years that they've existed. They have played in most of the major theaters, and they've worked with many of the, we this summer we did a short tour of three concerts with Cecilia Bartoli, who is
wonderful.
Yeah, and it was glorious because she is glorious. She's a glorious, glorious.
Yeah, I agree. A superb voice.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon. Finish up.
No, she knows how to use it. She knows her voice, so she doesn't take chances. She doesn't take on stuff that she shouldn't be singing, as some other singers are tempted to do.
Yeah, very true. So opera informed your first novel. I mean, you taught English. I love the chapter in your book where you're teaching English in China and the, you know, the difficulties there, but you taught language in various places. And then you wound up, how did you land a teaching gig in Italy?
I had been in Saudi Arabia, which I hated and still hate, I don't know how many, 40 years later. And I called my friends in Venice and I said, can I come and stay with you while I look for a house in Venice because I want to live there? Sure. So I stayed with them for a couple of weeks and I found an apartment and I stayed. And I said, Mr. Micawber, I'm just rereading David Copperfield. Mr. Micawber says somewhere, when inflow exceeds outflow, the result is happiness. When outflow exceeds inflow, the result is misery. And I didn't have an inflow, I just had an outflow. Right. And I somehow managed to get a job at the University of Maryland, who had the contract to do the university teaching for the military. And there was an American Air Force base in Aviano and an army base in Vicenza. So I started teaching in both places. And the glory of it was that I would teach at night because the students were busy saving democracy during the day. And I would be walking around the city, having lunch with friends, and then teaching at night. And I did that for a long, long time. I don't know, 15 years. I've never held a job so long because it was great because it allowed me to live in Italy and work in America, which was an ideal solution to the problem of income inflow and outflow. And it allowed me a certain flexibility about working. I had lots of time off because there was a break between semesters. And I didn't have to go to Italy because I was living in Italy. I did that for a long time. And then I got lucky. The book started to be printed and I didn't have to do that anymore.
I do think that you write very nicely about your interaction with your students in your memoir. I mean, I really enjoyed reading how.
Oh, they were sweeties. They were sweetie pies. The only time I ever raised my voice with one of them, he came in one day. He had been on guard duty. I looked at the guy and I said, "Hey, look. You've been told you can't bring your rifle into the English class. Go put it in the go put it somewhere. You can't come into this room with a gun." But they were, some of them were extraordinarily bright. And I soon came to realize that a lot of them joined the military, not because they really wanted to be in the military, but because the military would pay for their education. So a lot of these guys and women would stay in the military until they had their degree and then they'd leave.
Well, that's true, although some of them in the higher, you know, like West Point and Naval Academy and so forth.
Yeah.
He had to agree to stay for 20 years, but then, you know, they got there. I had two or three classmates who went to Annapolis or West Point when I graduated from high school. And that was the deal, you know, was that they would put in their 20 years and in return, you know, they got to go to Annapolis or West Point or whatever. Of course, you know, I graduated in 1958 and none of us knew that Vietnam was lying right over the horizon. So, you know, it may not have been such a great deal.
Not the best choice you ever made, George.
Well, you know, my first husband that I married at Stanford was turned into a Green Beret down, you know, educated at Fort Ord and off he went. So anyway, so there you are in Venice and you're teaching and you have a pretty good inflow, outflow arrangement. What inspired you to write Death at La Fenice? And is that, in fact, your first published book?
Yeah. It's the first book I wrote. I was maybe a year or a year and a half before that, I was in the opera house at La Fenice with a friend of mine who was then conducting at La Fenice. And during a rehearsal, he and his wife and I started talking about another conductor. And there was an escalation. And we started thinking about how to kill him here in the dressing room. And I said, oh, great idea for a book. I wonder if I could write a book. So I went off, never having thought in my life of writing a book, of trying to write a book. And I wrote a book. And then I sent it to a contest in Japan, of all things, and it won. And then I got a contract for two books. So I had to write a second book, and then a third and a fourth. And then the angels came down and saved me from a career that was going absolutely nowhere because the first four books were not successful. They were successful, but they weren't real winners. I was offered a contract by a small publisher in Switzerland, Diogenes, it was run by a family, and it was a personal thing. And I said, yeah, okay, fine. And they made my career. If I am successful today, it is because of Diogenes. And their knowledge with the European reader, because the books became bestsellers in the German language.
Right.
And while they were still not printed and reprinted in America, because they were out of print for a couple of years. And finally, at about book 8 or 9, they jumped back on board. Thank God it was Grove Atlantic, who has proven to be a very, very fine publisher. But it is Diogenes who sold, and they became my agent. So they did all of the sales to the other countries.
Well, my much beloved Martin Walker, who writes the Bruno Chief of the History, is also published by Diogenes.
I know.
You know, they are indeed very successful. But I remember, I've had the pleasure and the privilege of reading Donna's books in real time from Death at La Fenice. In fact, if you look behind me, I have Donna's entire oeuvre on the shelf there, all autographed by Donna, and all UK editions, as a matter of fact, because Donna's gone to London so often to sign books. And when she won the Silver Dagger, which is Britain's version of the Edgars, Mystery Writers of America from the British Crime Writers Association, they give out dagger awards. And they keep sort of changing the name. But when Donna won the Silver Dagger, I was there, which was wonderful. And we went to tea at Fortnum and Mason afterward to celebrate.
Where else would one go, darling?
Well, we did. And then, Donna, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but when there were two publishers bidding for you at the time that you ended up choosing Grove Atlantic, and both publishers talked to me about what I estimated your career trajectory would be. And I was in New York, and I can still remember walking through Central Park holding my phone and having this discussion. And then the New York Times, if you remember the article, the New York Times called me. And once again, I was walking through Central Park with my phone while we discussed your career. I was such an advocate.
Thank you.
Well, I don't know. Somewhere I actually have the article from the Times, from the book review that, you know, where I'm heavily quoted in it. But I really, you know, I fell in love with Guido Brunetti and the whole gang and Death at La Fenice, which I think has a very, I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, but it has a really interesting plot. And then Donna's books, if you've seen them or turned into television, but by a German company with a German cast, right? And it, somewhere in the middle, a new person became Brunetti. Remember?
Yeah.
So I often wondered, do you think that there's any chance that are the rights still with Diogenes for the, or whoever the German company was?
No, the rights are now in the process of being talked about. We were getting, it's almost like a fall down comedy movie from the 30s. We were walking to the altar when the strike happened, in Hollywood happened, and everything. In fact, I had gone to London to meet the person who was in charge of the project. And it was a nice marriage. We got on very well. She and her husband were palpably intelligent people and palpably intelligent readers. And we said, yeah, this would be great. And they said, yeah, but there's the strike and it's probably going to go on until next year. And so it has turned out to be that it just keeps going on.
Well, no, it's been
the one with the writers is settled, but the one with the actors isn't settled.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought for some reason it had all been. Does that really affect, is this an American company? Because European companies are not affected by.
It's an American company.
Ah. Well, we can hope because, you know, it's such an impressive body of work by now with so many novels. You know, you've written a couple of other things, that nonfiction and all, but have you ever been tempted to write something outside Brunetti?
No, I haven't. I don't see any reason to do it because I have such wonderful fun with Brunetti and with the other members of the squad. And I know who of them will make the wise ass remark and who will be funny, because the things I like best in the books are always the funny things. And having everything at my beck and call and in my memory, I can do that. And were I to start all over again with a new group of people, I would have to do the introduction and this is and decide on what narrative voice to use, whether first person.
Somebody asked me, I was at I can't remember where it was, some mystery conference or other, where Louise Penny was being interviewed. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked her if she had ever thought about writing something besides Miss Petra Gamache and all. And Louise said, no, she said, I've only had one good idea and I'm sticking with it. But I think what she really meant by that is what you just said. I don't think she meant that in a smart ass way. I think what she really meant was she was so comfortable and fond of, you know, the world and the characters that she had created that she didn't see any reason.
Well, she should be.
Yeah, well, but you too, you know, why go into another universe, so to speak?
When you're so as good as she is at what she does.
Well, and you are also, and you know, the wonderful thing about Italy is that in Venice, is you never run out of plot ideas. I mean, ever, you know, they just keep spewing up around you.
Oh, yes. I read the Gazzettino every day. And every second day, at least, there's something where the light goes off on top of my head. And I say, yeah, that would work.
Well, there's so many, you know, there's so many social issues, there's so many political issues. You've always got fabulous food. You know, I wish I could remember where it was, and I'm pretty sure it was in the Giudecca, but during that week where we were there, where it was like 100 degrees, the New York Times had done a little article about places to eat in Venice that they highly recommend, and they talked about you could get the perfect, what's the little potato? I'm having a mental blank here. The little potato pasta, you know, the
gnocchi.
Thank you. The most perfect gnocchi and tomato sauce were in this little restaurant over in the Giudecca. So Rob and I got back on the water, you know, crossed over there and wandered the streets looking for it. I mean, it was so hot. You could barely, honestly, it was even hard to breathe. And we found it, and we were the only people there because nobody really wanted to be out.
It was too hot to eat.
And they set us in a little piazza outside the restaurant and all, and they served us. And indeed, it was the most fabulous gnocchi and tomato sauce ever. But it was so difficult to focus on the food when you were barely able to. The air was so thick, you know, because the humidity, obviously, and the heat was that, you know, it even felt like an effort to move your hands and your fork, let alone to breathe. I've always wanted to go back. And of course, I have absolutely no idea now what the name of it was or whether it would still be there. Do restaurants in Venice tend to last a long time? Do they go through families? You know, can you expect to find one, you know, 15 years down the road?
Yeah, if it's a good, usually it's the expensive ones because they are sure of, they have enough money to continue. Very often, if something happens to someone who's opened a restaurant and it's been in business for 2 years, he hasn't built up the clientele. And so if the economy gets difficult, these are the people who leave, who close, or if they, for some reason, they've chosen the wrong place, that it often happens that people who are not Venetian start businesses in the city, not knowing that they have bought a building that has, it's almost a curse. There are certain places in Venice where I walk past often, where I see a new business every year, because for some reason they do not prosper in that particular location. I can never figure it out. I've talked to with Venetian friends, and they say, yeah, those are places that just are.
No, that's I think that's true. There's a restaurant on the corner of Scottsdale Road and something right down from us that must be in its fifth incarnation. And I think this one might make it, but it's certainly true that very often, I don't know whether it's the foot traffic or whatever. My experience shopping in Venice was an interesting one. I found a shoe store. Venice, I think, you know, Italy, you think shoes, right? A lot. Mm-hmm. I still have one of the pairs, but I found these absolutely marvelous shoes that had kind of a bit of a rubber sole with little round things so that you could walk on the cobblestones and all the rest. You know, you weren't getting your heels mm-hmm. inserted in the whatever. Anyway, I bought them in black and I liked them so much, I thought I would go back and see if I could find other colors. So finding it again, that was the first mm-hmm. challenge. But when I got there, their stock all came from Mestre or someplace. And mm-hmm. so they were out. You know, and they didn't seem to have any expectation that it would be a good idea to reorder. And so I've often wondered, you know, some of these little boutiques in the city, whether they are there to serve the locals, are they there to catch the tourists, and, you know, what their business plan is, because clearly the shoe store didn't really have one.
Yeah, I think that many shops in Italy don't have a business plan. There, it's something to do. It's an exercise in hope that somehow they will manage to find the product or the shoe that everyone will want. And very often that doesn't happen. And places close up very quickly.
Yeah.
Well, since I go intermittently,
right.
I see no one, then a store, and then no one, and then a store.
It always seemed to me that there was this interesting balance between the really old and the ephemeral in Venice. You know, mm-hmm. that there were many things that, I mean, you can't move without hearing Vivaldi, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and churches and so forth, but, and, you know, marvelous art and the whole bit, but then other things, you feel like you're just, they're almost like gossamer, you know, that, mm-hmm. that they're going to disappear on you. So,
yeah, and they do.
Yeah, it's a constantly evolving, I think, city, despite its long lineage and interesting beginnings. I mean, if anybody, you know, wonders how come there's a city out there on the water, it's actually not on the water, it's built on wooden pilings, you know, that were mm-hmm. by people who were trying to escape marauding, I can't remember, whatever, marauding tribes, and thought that the sea would be a safe place. And, you know, if anybody's paid any attention to how timber and water work, it only works if the timber stays in the water. For example, when they brought up Henry VIII's ship, the whatever it was, and there's a museum in Stockholm dedicated entirely to this 17th century ship that, you know, they dredged up. If you don't keep the wood wet when you bring it back out of the water, you know, it all collapses. So the tides and all the rest of it, I think Venice is very vulnerable, don't you, to, you know, in its foundations.
It is, and they've, in a way, they've become even more vulnerable with Mose, with
right.
these up and down.
Yeah, the gates to prevent the flooding.
Yeah.
Right,
so
but the flooding
worked.
Yeah, but the flooding may be the thing that has allowed it to last as long as it has.
Yeah.
Interesting indeed. So tell us, do we have a new book that we can look forward to in March?
I think it might be May this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you planning to travel at all? Like,
excuse
for example,
me?
Are you planning to travel at all when the book comes out?
Maybe a couple of things in Germany, but I won't say I don't have the energy. I don't have the desire anymore to travel for work. I don't want to do that anymore. I was just at the book fair in Bordeaux, but that's because I know the people. I've known them for a long time and they've been very good to me. So I said, yeah, I'll come, bed bugs or not. So I went and there were no bed bugs.
So if I were to tell you that I will be in Basel, Switzerland on the 18th of December, staying at the Three Kings, would I be able to lure you to come and join us for dinner?
I have to look at my book.
Wait. Well, you don't have to answer me right now. I'm just throwing out the invitation because clearly this is a case that the mountain is not coming to Mohammed. So I, Mohammed, am going to have to journey to the mountain, which closest I can journey there is like Basel, Switzerland.
Basel's lovely, lovely, lovely town.
It is. And it's a truly glorious hotel with, I'm happy to say, a 3-star Michelin restaurant. And if you're sitting on the terrace, you get to look out on the Rhine Falls because this is where the Rhine River begins. So you can let me know when it's...
Tell me the date again.
It is the 18th of December.
I am in Reggio Emilia for a week, not for the Parmesan, but because Il Pomodoro is recording Jephtha. Uh-huh.
And I will be rejected for opera. Well, it's only fair.
Sorry.
That's all right. I was just hopeful there. Well, anyway, Wandering Through Life is a truly marvelous book. I will say that the narrative structure somewhat reflects the title. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah. But this came about because Diogenes asked me if I would authorize a publication of collected essays that I wrote 20 years ago, 25 years ago, for the German press, the Swiss press, and the English press. And I said, yeah, sure. Just put them together and let me read through them. And that's how the book came. I didn't plan this. They did. And I liked some of them so much because I had completely forgotten them. Some of the things, the Saudi Arabia one, I laughed out loud at some of it.
Well, I enjoyed that, but I thought your time in China was really interesting, especially as it's going. So there's much for the reader to mine. And, you know, turning 80 is a landmark, and so probably was a good, not one I myself enjoyed or even chose, but here we are, both of us, right? But, you know, a good moment in which to think back on your life and, you know, realize that my husband often says to me when I regret something in the past, and he always says to me, but if you hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here. And that's so true, isn't it, Donna? That right. Whatever choices you made, both good and bad, and the things that you really wish you could have a do-over for, but the truth is you wouldn't be where you are right this moment.
No.
If in fact, you had any do-overs, would you?
I regret the things I didn't do, but
yes,
I don't regret any of the things I did.
And, you know, that's so important. And as we're getting older and we have less time, you know, I wish to say, well, I'll do that someday. Someday is becoming remarkably close at hand. Mm-hmm. I do think it's important to think about, you know, what will I regret that I didn't do? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I do that. So my tendency is to say yes, which is why Rob is now planning some interesting cruise off West Japan and a tour of Hokkaido next May. And you know, Quebec, which I have to tell you, Quebec, since you've just been in Bordeaux, has all the advantages of France without the French, which has, I'm sorry to say, but it has a lot of appeal. It's a beautiful city. So, you know, it's good to keep wandering. I love that. Ian, come and join us and see if we have any questions from the audience as we have meandered through this lovely hour discussion.
Yes, there are some questions for Donna.
Great.
First, do you think you would ever have Brunetti visit Switzerland?
No. I don't know enough about Switzerland to write intelligently about it. And it would end up just being sort of pot shots at a different culture. He has to, for me to write about him, he has to stay in Italy.
What years did you teach in Abbiano?
Oof. 81, 2, 3, 4, 5, around in there, in the 80s.
Is it still true your books are not translated in Italian?
Yeah, that's my decision, because I had the experience of people who did not read the books, Italians, friends of mine, not close friends, who did not read the books, but who read about the books, about this foreigner. Who was writing to say that there's corruption in Italy, there's problems in Italy, there's crime in Italy. And they were really heated up. And I thought, I would get this from a lot of people. If these books were published in Italian, there would be articles in the newspapers about this foreigner. who dares to criticize Italy? And it would raise people's feathers. It would upset them, understandably, because we can talk about our native country and say bad things about our native country, but it's not the same thing when someone who isn't an American says it. And I feel it too. Let me insult my country, but don't you dare to do it.
I'm surprised
by that too. Sorry.
What's been the best compliment you've received over your career?
Someone I have a nice thing that happens, but the thing I like the most was someone, an English person, said something about how funny the books are. And the nice thing was that a number of people, to my complete surprise, have said that when she was dying, my mother, my aunt, my sister, my father, my uncle, my brother took great comfort from your books. That is a remark that I will never, ever understand. But it was very, very moving for me to have people tell me that. But I don't understand.
Was there no context for that?
No, these were people who were terminally ill, who read my books they weren't reading the Bible. They were reading the stories of Guido Brunetti. But there's maybe something about the security of the family or the security of the bond among the characters. And many people were strongly enough surprised or impressed by it that they told me. And I'm surprised totally by this.
Well, certainly the marriage between Guido and Paola is a wonderful thing to read about, the way they behave with their children, Brunetti's mother and her exit. But Guido, in many ways, my absolute favorite interaction is the ongoing developing one between Guido and his in-laws, particularly the Count. Mm-hmm. And I think in your last book, it was really nice, the De Felieris and Guido, you know, talking about, because there are class divisions in Venice, and that's something you definitely write about. And Paola's family is very much of the
top upper, of the top.
Yeah, in the golden book, so to speak. And, you know, Guido comes from a working family. And so, you know, there's also, I think their love of literature is another thing, Paola and Guido, you know, the way they read, the way they read each other, they respect each other. That dynamic, I think, is, and it's one way reason Guido and his father-in-law, I think, get along. But do you think the humor comes more down at the, you know, at the cop shop, so to speak, between Guido's ghastly boss?
No,
really kind of he is unintentionally, you lampoon him in really in many ways, you know, he's Italian, but it's in a kind way. You don't really,
I like him enormously. But the funny things are usually funny in the British sense, like calling the prime minister Hobbes, because he's like Hobbes' description of human life, nasty, brutish, and short. And the then prime minister was short. He was also nasty and brutish, but he was also short.
But I think, you know, Signora Electra, her ability to manage things is often, there's a lot of humor involved there. I love the way she operates, you know, with like the financial police and so forth, you know, her unauthorized entries into other systems are terrific.
She is like a bed bug. She can get in anywhere.
You're right. She is.
And cause trouble.
Sorry, Ian, we got carried away. I got carried away there. What else do you have?
And finally, who do you recommend people read?
Dickens.
Well, that's just because you're reading Dickens at the moment.
No.
No? It's bigger than that?
No, it's bigger than that. I adore Dickens. I think he is the great English novelist. No, maybe Jane Austen is the great English novelist, but certainly on the list, on the short list, is Dickens. I'm coming to what I remember because I've read it twice before. There's a part I really want to jump over where he, in a very moralistic way, sums up the last two chapters of the book. And I really don't want to read that because it's really pretty awful. But up until that point, David Copperfield is so good. And now I think enough time has passed. I'm going to read, because I just finished the book for next year and I've sent it off. Now I can lie on the sofa for a month and read Bleak House, which is my favorite of the books. I think that people should read what they like to read. And I also think that they should take a look at the classics at Trollope and Dickens and Austen, because they all use beautifully sounding and beautifully written English sentences. There's a deluge of beautiful sentences in Austen, Trollope, and Dickens. And I think that they will teach people how to write a sentence, because a book is just a collection of sentences, but they should each make sense and they should each be good. And they will teach someone who wants to write how to write.
I'm myself a fan of Trollope, and to my great regret, The Palliser's, which was brilliant television when it was made forever ago, and actually launched Derek Jacobi on his career. Susanna York was in, trying to remember, looks unbelievably dated if you try to watch it now. We did try, but I wish somebody would remake it, because I think that collection by that whole sequence by Trollope is really amazing. I can't read Dickens, Donna, because there's so much dialect in it, and I am such a speed reader that it just is like having a continual series of speed bumps. I'll never be able to read Thackeray. I will never ever be able to read Vanity Fair. I just can't do it. So that's just, you know, a quirk of me. But Trollope,
so bad.
I know it is sad, but you know, so that's why I read Trollope rather than Dickens, yeah. Because you know, he really just an amazing, I think, and often overlooked.
And he understood women, which Dickens did not. Dickens didn't have a clue about women. They were either virgin mothers or whores. Those are your options, girls. You have to be sweet and virtuous and obedient and submissive, or independent, and that'll lead you to hell.
Yeah, but Dickens is really good on boys. You know,
yes, he was.
I mean, really, really good. I mean, you know, I've seen Dickens dramatized since I can't read him, and I'm always impressed at how well he understood boys.
Yeah, their loyalty, their weakness,
yeah,
their virtues and their vices.
And he also highlighted nature versus nurture. You know, there was, mm-hmm. I think, if you look at the how some of the people in Dickens managed to overcome their truly terrible beginnings, and some of them never could. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very Victorian, I think, you know, in the sense that the Victorians, you know, that was a constant thing going on, because the Victorians really thought that life was getting better and better, you know, would continually get better.
With no evidence.
Well, but you know, they were starting in on the industrial age, and things could be done that never had been done before.
True.
And and they'd colonized the world. And so for them, it was a very optimistic time. They came to a shrieking halt in 1914, you know, but mm-hmm. up until then, it was kind of an ascending curve.
Yeah, true.
You know? But we're not here to talk about that. Actually, let's talk a final go round here for wandering through life. What is it that you intend to wander through for the remaining years of yours?
Well,
any particular plans?
On Friday, I'm at La Rondine at the Zurich Opera. And Saturday, I'm at Circe in Halle, because a friend of mine is singing Circe. I will try to spend more time with music and with musicians, because it's a work group for which I have tremendous respect. I love musicians because I'm so in awe of what they can do, particularly singers. I'm just I'm a sucker for a great singer. I think it's as close to heavenly as humans can come. So I want very much, and I'm going to Berlin too for Idomeneo. From Circe, I go up to Berlin for Idomeneo. And then I'm just going to spend the next couple of months really going to the opera as much as I can. to see things, because there's a lot of Handel floating around in Europe.
A wonderful home. Right. Well, I wish you all the best for the holidays, and I will hope that we'll have a chance to talk again. If not, not before May, maybe just for fun at some point. Thank you very much, all of you, for watching us. And we do have still have copies of Wandering Through Life, but they're available at almost any bookstore. So pick one up and immerse yourself in a life very well lived with many chapters to go. Bye, Donna. Thank you.
Thanks. Ciao, ciao.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.